the theology that he was being taught by his great teachers, whom he loved, was some theology that you could live with, but you couldn't die with. Think of that.
You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
Today, we begin a brief series on the life and work of pastor, theologian, and author Herman Zassa with the Reverend Dr. Matthew Harrison.
Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University St. Paul. You can learn more about Concordia University St. Paul at csp.edu.
Joining us today, the Reverend Dr. Matthew Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Pastor Harrison, welcome back to The Coffee Hour.
It's always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Earlier this spring, we sat down for about 12, 15 minutes right before Share-a-thon and said, let's talk about a topic, a theological topic of your choice. Herman Zassa came to the top of the list. He gave us just a brief overview of his life and his work. And I said, we need more time with Pastor Harrison.
We need more time.
So we decided to prepare for a series on this. So today, where do you want to start with Zassa? Can we start with like his early life and upbringing? Where was he born and his family, those types of things? What do we know about that?
Sure. Just before we start, Robert Price said that the three greatest theologians, Lutheran theologians of the 20th century, were Francis Pieper, Werner Ehlert, and Hermann Zassa.
Mm.
And by saying that, he recognized Zassa's importance on teaching Lutherans what the Lord's Supper really is, teaching Lutherans what the church is, helping us struggle with what the Word of God is, and numerous other things. Quintessential historian who's had a lot of influence on confessional Lutherans in the last century and now second century coming after his birth. So it's important to study him. Yes, Zassa was born in Lower Lusatia, not far from Berlin, in a little town called Sonnenwald. His father was a pharmacist, and he was born in 1895. And he said one time, not to have lived before World War I in Germany was not to know how wonderful life could possibly be. It was a very optimistic time. Socially optimistic, economically optimistic. It was also a time of theological optimism, which was not good. Theology had drifted into the study of myths and believing that a lot of the New Testament was myth, and the Old Testament certainly mythologies. And so this came to dominate. And also the theology of ethics, more than sacrifice and God in the flesh sacrificing himself for the sins of the world, came to dominate much of the theological enterprise, especially in Prussia, where he was born, Berlin, Brandenburg, Prussia. And he came to see all of that clearly only through great, great tragedy and trials in life. He studied as a student in Mecklenburg, as a grade school student, high school student, Lübeck, and Breslau in Silesia. And then he ends up going to university, the University of Berlin, in 1913 or so to study. And he ends up studying philology, especially, that is languages, Greek language. He has some of the greatest scholars in the world at the time at what was recognized as the greatest university. The Humboldt University still exists in Berlin to this day. He did his main work with a guy named Adolf Deismann. Deismann's very, very famous for having helped understand the origins of the New Testament documents and their context. Ancient Light from the East, Near East, was one of his most famous books. But Deismann once described the Christology of the New Testament, that is, who is Christ, by saying, well, it isn't the technical things Paul says about Jesus, like, or the New Testament says about Jesus, like, I and the Father are one, all the fullness of the Godhead dwells in him bodily in Colossians and others. Those aren't the important things, Deismann said. Deismann said, it's like you're on a steamship in the river, and what's important is not all those cogs and wheels and engine and everything else. What's really important is you feel the rumble as you go. So you know there's something going on, which is profound, but all the mythological trappings around the side are really kind of not the main thing, which just seems like a really foolish thing to say because, you know, a steamboat would sit and hum all you want. You could get it to make a gurgling or humming noise or whatever, but if it didn't have wheels and cogs and rods and everything else, it would sit there in the, and just float with the tide. Yeah, kind of crazy. But he was very close to Adolf Deissmann. Deissmann later became very influential on him in really the first professional part of his life, because Deissmann was deeply involved in the Faith and Order movement, which was a predecessor to the World Council of Churches.
Hmm.
And Deissmann got Zasa involved, and it was Ron Feuerhahn, may his soul rest in peace. It was Ron Feuerhahn's thesis, his PhD thesis, that Zasa was the most active theologian in the ecumenical movement in the continent, on the continent before World War II. So, which gave rise to his self-description as being a confessional ecumenist, which it's would seem to be a contradiction in terms, but it's not. We'll get to that sometime, hopefully down the road a bit. But anyway, Adolf Deissmann was very involved in that activity and got Zasa involved, and later on, he studied Latin with Edward Norden, who was a prolific expert in Greek. He learned from Wilhelminus Mehlendorf on Greek poetry, Pindar, Aristotle, especially Plato. And he never forgot. Well, he always said that we went into the trenches. He was a chaplain of 1916. We went into the trenches in World War I. And by the way, he fought at Passchendaele, one of the most horrible places in Belgium. We went into the trenches with Pindar and Sophocles, our Greek poets, and we came out reading our Greek New Testaments.
Hmm.
And he realized that the theology that he was being taught by his great teachers, whom he loved, was some theology that you could live with, but you couldn't die with.
Hmm.
Think of that.
Hmm.
You could live with this, and when times are marvelous, but not when things are horrible. He studied with Eisfeld and Gressmann and Baudisson. All these guys were the great sort of initiators of the form critical movement. It's what finally, in large measure, the controversy was about in the 60s and 70s in the Missouri Synod. You know, are the Old Testament accounts actually what God said and did, or are they simply mythological documents that were changed over time by various editors trying to put their own political or national or religious ideas in the text to sway it their way, the result of much changing over time? But he had studied it all with these guys. The two that really influenced him the most were Karl Hull and Otto von Harnack. And Otto von Harnack's dates are about the same as Francis Pieper, 1854 to 1931. And von Harnack was a fantastic scholar. He could quote the fathers in various languages at length. Hull could do that especially. And he was a historian of dogma in the German, Dogmensgeschichte, it's called. And they say German is a polite appearing excuse to spit on other people. But and this was trying to figure out the origin, the origins of various Christian doctrines, and where did they come from? And you would think this would be a fairly straightforward pursuit, but not when you don't believe the New Testament is in any way factual. And you believe that ideas about God's rising and dying, or being virgins giving birth and miracles, they're all, and sacrifices for sin, all those are imported from other religions at the time the New Testament was written. So it's nothing straightforward. It becomes an attempt to unravel what the real Jesus was. There was a huge search for the historical Jesus in the 19th century. And Zasa, when he came out of all this stuff, he laughed later and he said, "Oh, the Germans looked intensely in the New Testament for decades trying to figure out who the real Jesus was. And when they finally gave their answer, he was a liberal German with wire-rimmed glasses looking back at them from the New Testament."
Oh, no.
In other words, they just created a Jesus quite after their own mind. So Harnack basically reduced Christianity to ethics. If you don't believe there's a God-man, if you don't believe there's an incarnation, if you don't believe in any kind of real sense, what do you have left? And what's left is basically ethics. Goethe had said that basically, I think religion is, I think he said Gesinnung und Tat. It's sentiment and deed, ethics, feelings and ethics. That's what religion is good for. Schleiermacher, a century early, the father of all liberal theology, had basically tried to restore Christianity on the barren desert of rationalism, which had wiped out all the supernatural was wiped out. It's kind of like Jefferson's New Testament, you know, cut out all the miracles and everything else. And the last thing in Jefferson's Bible says, "And they rolled the stone to the tomb," the end. So Schleiermacher tries to restore that by saying, well, at least religion is something about, has something to say about feelings, positive feelings, a dependence upon God, and a resulting ethical service of my neighbor. So, but the thing had all, things had only gotten worse by 1900 when Harnack was on top of the heap at the Humboldt University. And his other great professor was Karl Hull. And Karl Hull was, I think, similar dates. But there came a Lutheran Reformation anniversary in 1917. In the Missouri Synod, we celebrated with a number of books, and especially with the publication of the Triglot, the big mule-choking edition, three-language edition of the Book of Concord, which every pastor must have, even yet today, if nothing else but to do, various weight exercises with it. It's a great monument. But out of that Reformation, in the year 1917, Karl Hull gave a great lecture, "What Did Luther Understand by Religion?" And lo and behold, out of that, there were things that were deficient in it. Zasa always complained that Karl Hull was deficient on Luther's view of the sacraments. But the gospel rang out, and there came a Luther revival from Karl Hull and company. And Zasa was, in a way, Zasa was a part of that. As a student. So he finished up his student years at the university and soon was right off in uniform to fight in Passchendaele, and he was in the army for a couple of years, I think.
We're talking about Hermann Zasa with Reverend Dr. Matthew Harrison. We have more to talk about after we take a quick break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
Who am I? How has God gifted me? Where is God calling me to serve? Concordia University St. Paul helps students explore the answers to these questions. Through a Christ-centered Lutheran higher education, dedicated faculty, and engaging academic programs, CSP is here to walk alongside you in your educational journey. With more than 100 degree programs from undergraduate to graduate offered in person and online, CSP aims to prepare you for success however God calls you. Visit csp.edu to discover and engage your calling today.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
We're talking about the life of Hermann Zasa with the Reverend Dr. Matthew Harrison, and you've been sharing his early life, his influences. What was that political context, the cultural context in the early 1900s in Germany that eventually led to him serving in World War I?
Well, this was before democracy had arisen in Germany. There had been in the mid-1800s, around 1850, there had been a number of revolutions throughout Europe where socialist organizers and others were really pushing for democratic ideals. And some communists, too. Of course, communism comes right out of Karl Marx, who was a German, but right out of that milieu in the center part of the century. And by the way, evolution plays a big part in communism, as it does in biblical studies in the period, because, you know, evolution is you have a thesis, antithesis, you have sort of the status quo, the thesis running along historically, and then an antithesis develops against it. There's a clash in politics. It's a revolution. And then comes a synthesis, a new direction forward. So, that philosophy from Hegel was applied to the New Testament. And so obviously the New Testament and the Old Testament had to be products of a large political, long-standing political struggle. So you got to figure out who wrote actually what bit here and what bit there and for what purpose and what was their, you know, their interest and everything. That was especially the JDP paradigm of the Old Testament came right out of these teachers of Zasa. What was the question?
Political context of the time.
Context, yeah. So there was no democracy going on, and the Archduke Ferdinand was shot. I don't know all the complexities of what started the World War I, but I do know this. By the end of the war, then, the entire political order, which had been established by the Treaty of Vienna, I believe, after the Napoleonic Wars, which for Lutherans was totally devastating because they gave Wittenberg to the Prussians.
Mm.
And the Prussians, Prussian leaders were reformed. So that holds, the new era holds, you've got all this this system of nobility around all of Europe. And then what happens with World War I is all of that is swept aside and replaced by the Weimar Republic, which is a democracy. And so that meant the entire church system was thrown on its head because since the Reformation, the sort of summus episcopus dogma reigned, that is, the head of the state was essentially functionally the head of the church, like you have in Church of England now. So all of that is set aside, and there's chaos. Zasa hopes for a reinstitution of proper Lutheran church governance for Lutheran churches and not amalgamations of Lutheran Reformed and United and other things. So as a matter of fact, in 1933 in Wittenberg, the DEK is formed, the German Evangelical Church, which Hitler forced together. It's a union, and Zasa lays a paper on every desk at the meeting protesting the union that is formed between Lutherans and Reformed. And they elect von Bodelschwing as the president of the church, but the Hitlerites push him out. And guess who Hitler gets pushed in? Heinrich Müller, his old chaplain, World War I buddy, becomes the head of the DEK. Wow. Disappointment. So, you know, the Weimar Republic was with tariffs and war reparations and all those kind of economic problems, it was too much, too fast for the Germans to bear, I suspect. And then gave rise, of course, to the radical movements of the Nazis in the 20s. And Sasse was right there for that. He comments on it early. He comments upon the problems of party membership and Christians joining the party. He comments upon the rise of the Deutsche Christen movement, the German Christian movement. And these German Christians, which Sasse says, were mostly in the Prussian region or areas where the Union had happened, the Prussian Union had happened, which said, you know, Lutheran, Calvinist, real presence, real absence, you know, these are immaterial things. We're all evangelical Christians. So those challenges were right there. The German Christians, and Harnack was basically on board with them, they despised Jews. And they invented stupid theories to say that, like, Jesus, this Aryan, jettisoned into the Holy Land and then, you know, jettisoned out again, I guess, but that the Jews were absolutely inferior and, you know, a decadent race and everything else. Sasse is watching this, and already in the early days of Nazism, 1933. In fact, I've got the book right here with me. This Kirchliches Jahr book, 1933 to 1944. This is an original. And this is where Sasse calls the Nazis to account. And he is the first guy to do this of any significance. And he writes this extraordinary paragraph. One can perhaps forgive National Socialism all its theological sins, but this Article 24 excludes any possibility of a dialogue with the Church, whether Protestant or Catholic. In Article 24, the party says it supports so-called positive Christianity, which they just mean ethical, if you support their kind of ethics, their Nazi ethics. And it fights against the Jewish materialistic spirit at home and abroad, blah, blah, blah. So Sasse responds, Rosenberg's myth of the 20th century, for all its blasphemies and its extravagant nonsense about the history of religions and of the world, is a harmless and venial lapse compared with this article, which condemns the Jews, basically. He says, evangelical theology can enter into dialogue with the National Socialists on all points of the party program, even about the Jewish question and its understanding of a race. It may be perhaps able to take seriously the whole rest of the program. About this article, however, no discussion at all is possible, for the Protestant Church would have to begin such a discussion with a frank admission that its doctrine constitutes a deliberate, permanent insult to, quote, the German race's sense of decency and morality. That's what Article 24 said. Your religion is okay unless you threaten the German race's sense of decency and morality. Oh. Some decency and morality. And hence that she can have no expectation of tolerance within the Third Reich. And then he nails it on the doctrine of justification. According to the Protestant doctrine of original sin, the newborn infant of the noblest Germanic descent, endowed in body and mind with the optimal racial characteristics, is as much subject to eternal damnation as the genetically gravely compromised half-caste from two decadent races. And we must go on to confess that the doctrine of justification of the sinner, sola gratia, sola fide, is the end of Germanic morality, just as it is the end of all human morality. Oh, wow.
With about a minute left, any other influences on the life of Sasse next episode, we'll get into his work, more of his work,
sure,
and what he's written. Anything else?
Big influence was 1926. He gets a scholarship to go to the U.S. And he studies at Hartford Seminary. It was a seminary connected with the Church of the Old Prussian Union, the Union Church, which he was part of, and where he was ordained in 1920. He gets a scholarship. He's a great student. Goes over, and it's in America that he reads Luther and the Lutheran Confessions, especially. And he also reads Wilhelm Leah's three books on the Church. And these have a profound effect on his life. And from that point on, he really is focused on the Lutheran Church, extricating the Lutheran Church from the Union, especially. Then he moves to teach at Erlangen, teaches at Erlangen along with Althaus and Ehlert. And he devotes his life to Lutheran churches having Lutheran church governments, cooperating with others, working with others to confess what is true, but not practicing fellowship where there are differences. In fact, he says there's more true unity of the church where Christians are honest about their disagreements than when they act as though they don't matter. So it was huge. American Lutheranism and the American scene was a huge influence on him in other ways too.
We will learn more in our next episode with Pastor Harrison on Hermann Zassa. Our guest today, the Reverend Dr. Matthew Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Thank you so much for joining us today. Looking forward to our next conversation. You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Eddie Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.